Hey gang, welcome to National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, rbnrepublicbroadcasting.org. And today my guest is Tom Kaczynski from Maine. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Well, thank you for coming back. And for those who haven't heard Tom before, he was the town manager of Jackman, Maine. And when it came to light that he actually thinks it's okay to be white, he got dismissed from his job. You're not allowed to do that. And it wasn't the people of Jackman, Maine who were responsible. It was the national media, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no one here really cared about that. It was the local media, then the national media, every level.
Yeah.
But by local, I don't mean in my town.
But, of course, these national media people, I don't know, they're going to see this blow up in their face because they would have been much better off with you in Jackman, Maine, making the lives of the people there better for those 1,000 or so people. But instead, they've unleashed you, and now you're this up-and-coming leader and political force in America, and I think they're really going to rue the day. So,
well, I appreciate the compliment, and I work every day to try to make that a true prophecy.
Well, I know you have the capability of doing this, and you have the intelligence, and you've got the courage. I want to take just a second before we get into the rest of what we're doing. Well, maybe we should do this at the end. We'll do it again at the end. But I know that when you lost your job, when this has impacts on insurance, and is it okay if I mention that you're trying to raise a little bit of money for to compensate for that?
Yeah, no, there's no problem with that. At this point, what I've done for the moment is, if people want to be supportive, probably the best way is if you go to Gab, which is the free speech social media site, gab.ai, and you look up Tom Kaczynski, TomKaczynski. I actually encourage people to follow me as a premium subscriber. It's $5 a month, and that has worked really well. Anyone can afford to do it. For those who want to be more circumspect, just send me an email at newalbion@protonmail.com, and I would be happy to tell you other ways to do it if you prefer to do it traditional ways. But I've had a lot of support so far. Very appreciative. It helps me and my wife Dana. I pay for not just us to live, but for our medical bills for her. So we really appreciate the outpouring of support, prayers, and everyone else who stood behind us. And as we go forward with some new measures here in the next few months, there should be other opportunities for people to support us who want to do so, where we're going to have some events in the future. And I think a book is probably about 2 or 3 months away. So,
well, we'll all look forward to that. There has been a lot going on. We can talk about some of the things later. We might want to get to the national scene later, but there's been a lot going on in, the alt-right. And maybe we could start off with Richard Spencer's announcement that he is canceling his university tour because of violence from Antifa.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that people are intimidated by Antifa, but I understand how it happens. We actually have people up here in Maine who have tailed us at meetings, literally following my car while I left an event. So I understand why, people who are responsible in the alt-right are trying to prevent people from getting hurt and taking a picture view like that. But I think that we need, as we go forward, to figure out ways to make clear what Antifa is about. And putting them out in the streets is something I think that reveals to the average person just what the face of Marxism and communism and evil looks like in this country. And, one of the things that they've been able to play against us is we've gone out in the streets where we present an image that allows the media to define us negatively based upon a narrative, you know, rightly or wrongly, they've been promoting for many decades. But if we go out there and you see, you know, good-looking young men and women who are out there looking like proud Americans, proud of their identity, and they're the ones getting attacked, especially with American symbolism, I think people would be amazed how quickly things will begin to turn around. And where Spencer, you know, didn't explicitly embrace that imagery, I think that when Antifa begins attacking people who are carrying American flags, we're going to see a very different response. And I think it's only a matter of time before someone else begins doing so and going out in the field to colleges in that way and making clear, maybe not to the college kids or to the paid provocateurs who go there, but to the American people writ large, that, you know, there is this gigantic, well-funded movement in this country that seeks to undermine everything we've been about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'm not really a strategist. I don't participate in the planning of these events, the organizing of these events. And so when I talk about it, I don't really want to sound critical, because the people who do plan and organize these events put in a lot of hard work, and who am I to, what do you call it, Monday morning quarterback. But, you know, I would think, I'm just throwing this out, you know, it is important to have, to go out into the public. It's important to have events, but I can certainly understand Richard Spencer's concern of creating, you know, what could be riots and what could wind up even like in Charlottesville, where our side was attacked, yet we were roundly condemned. And so you have to be able to manage it. So how about the idea of events, not like a mass rally or a speech at a university, but something where we would be drawing them out, but we could easily dissolve. So not a mass event necessarily where we'd have thousands of people. And yet, you know, if you want to stand your ground, you have to have a mass event, but something that would draw them out, but there would be no engagement. I don't know. You know, like, yeah. You announce an event, a speech or something, but not one that requires a huge amount of cooperation and prior planning and organization in cooperation with a university. But you have some sort of event that's going to bring them out. And then you have a way of, you know, not showing, or you're showing, but you're in a secure location, and so you don't have to have this kind of violent confrontation. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, it makes sense, but I think the challenge you have is just how you get people out for events generally. I mean, and this is at the heart of the issue of what Spencer is not doing now, and I don't blame him for it necessarily, but you know, we are getting deplatformed in so many different places. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had mirrors of, say, your, you know, broadcast on YouTube, the people who put those up now are removed. Mm-hmm. And you can't put things on Facebook as easily. Twitter purges are everywhere. And so it's becoming really hard to get our message out to people who aren't already aware. And so many of our people who agree with this, with these views, are forced to do so in anonymity. So getting out into public events, even if you try to have, say, a hall set aside where you have a nice event that's supposed to be safe and secure, is very difficult under the auspices of a hostile state and actors who are going to work against you. Mm. And who will work against even attendees. Like, I had a small event up here in Maine where we had a few people attending, just a dinner, a meet and greet, and there were people going through the parking lot taking pictures of license plates. I mean, this is stuff that belongs in the Stasi or something, you know, not in modern day America. But as long as that remains the case, we're going to have a very hard time organizing in person. And so I guess that is the challenge of the movement, because the event model is difficult to manage because of all the logistics involved. And I think it's fair, like you said, to not try to Monday quarterback everything, but how we sort of get people involved and engaged, because we know there are a lot of people who support these ideas, but we also know that for real reasons at this point, they have to work under the veil of anonymity. And one thing I've been trying to figure out is how we employ the resources we have rather than what we might wish we have. And I think it fits what you were saying, where we need to go ahead and encourage the left to act on their worst behavior. I mean, the truth is, it's a coalition that's held together only by hatred of the majority. And if we just encourage their own worst instincts to say that they should have everything instead of sharing, it's not hard for me to understand why, you know, intersectionality between Muslims, gays, and feminists might not hold together that well if, you know, we were clever about exploiting the contradictions. Because if you think about this, and I know you're a historian, so you'll appreciate this, a lot of times we've been presented these false choices to kind of maneuver us into a place we don't want to be. And it's worth considering if we might not be able to do the same if we go ahead and just say to the left, okay, maybe you can have what you want, and see how their different components deal with that. It's a very different model and strategy. And, you know, as someone who is involved in politics and municipal management, strategic thinking is something I work at. But it's a different way maybe we can look at things, because the problem that Spencer sort of identified of going out in the field is a universal one to this mm-hmm. movement, and not likely to solve itself anytime soon.
Well, so what I was trying to say before, and maybe I thought of a couple of examples of the types of things that might be done instead of, say, a mass rally or a march with a thousand or several hundred of us. What about a high-profile person or a few high-profile people holding a press conference? They announce a press conference on you know, City Hall, this front steps of City Hall or something, to draw out the enemy. And if it winds up getting canceled, you're getting the publicity, but you know what is lost. Maybe that's really what you want in the first place. Or you know, laying a wreath at a monument, or cleaning graves, or decorating you know, a cemetery with American flags.
Yeah, I think there are many opportunities, like you're saying, that go out there, and I think that's a better model. I mean, having a, you know, symposium. I mean, I think you look at an event like American or AMRIN, you know, as something that works very well in that sort of model, and that you could expand that a little bit and have, you know, public gatherings, and even more than that, you know, challenge them to debates. I mean, I'm a fan of internet blood sports, you know. Let's let them argue their case. And, you know, at least in my case, I know I've challenged the people up here, and they, to this point, have been scared of having those arguments. But, you know, they can't say they aren't given a voice if they're not willing to sit down and argue the case. And we should and can do that more often. So I think that's a good suggestion you have.
Well, we'll see. Okay. We have also the case of Professor Kevin MacDonald. He's been in the news for two things over the past week. One is he is now the official spokesman of the Paul Nealon campaign, which I think should be very mutually beneficial. I think Paul Nealon will benefit greatly from having somebody who has spent as long as, you know, as many decades as Kevin MacDonald has thinking about these issues, helping to mold Mr. Nealon's message into one that's very coherent and, you know, intellectually consistent. And also, it gives Kevin MacDonald a lot more visibility as well in, you know, more in the mainstream, media. And that's good. But also, Kevin MacDonald has been in the news because, I guess a few days ago, a young Jewish academic became the, you know, Professor MacDonald's books have been out there for over 20 years, but, and there was only one real book review, and that wasn't by an academic, I believe it was by a journalist. And so finally you have an academic book review that's critical of Professor MacDonald's book, I think it was A Culture of Critique that was reviewed. And, you know, The Culture of Critique really stands up. And so the arguments were all straw man arguments, I think largely centered around saying, well, look, some Jewish behavior is not supportive of Israel. And, of course, Professor McDonald was never saying that support of the state of Israel was the, you know, the ultimate objective. It was Jewish group interest.
Sure.
And that's not, and some Jews don't look at Israel as necessarily always being promoting Jewish group interest, especially if you're in the diaspora. It can be detrimental to diaspora Jewish interests. This all, you know, it brings Professor McDonald more into the to the forefront. And you do have, you have had it like a rash of people, well-known people, I think, including Ann Coulter and certainly Paul Neelan and others, who are tweeting that they're reading Culture of Critique. So what do you make of this, you know, this new higher profile for Kevin McDonald in The Culture of Critique?
Well, having read the book, I can say that what Professor McDonald did so brilliantly was he intelligently brought up the issue of why Jews do what they do. And I think one of the things that needs to change, I'll put this in a broader sense and then make it narrower, is that we need to be able to talk about group behaviors, recognizing that there are, of course, individuals who dissent from them, but that when you have groups behaving in ways that are disproportionate and to, you know, their percentage, or like you see placement, as you do with Jews, more in academia than you would any other group representative to their population, that you need to be able to talk about that intelligently. And what Kevin has done is he's made that where people can understand why they are a cosmopolitan culture and why they act in that way. Or, you know, and they don't just talk about them. He talked about Chinese and Southeast Asia and other groups. So this was not one of those things where, you know, it's some sort of facile anti-Semitism, but rather it's a scholarly exegesis of a big idea. And as people like Kevin do that and they get a bigger picture out there where they get more audience, I think people will begin to understand why people who are on the alt-right and who are radicals have been concerned about Jewish influence within Western society writ large, and that's a fair and legitimate challenge. I mean, we've had the triumph of decency over honesty for a very long time, where it's reached the point where it's become a stultifying form of censorship, and that Paul has brought Kevin in there, and you see Ann Coulter talking about this and other people, and just like there with white genocide in South Africa. As these issues come into the light, then they're going to require answers, and you can't just censor away the reality of events by saying that, you know, it's impolitic to talk about certain groups. And if the left continues to do that, they will only send more people to people like Kevin and Paul and hopefully myself to start answering some of these questions that the mainstream is just pretending doesn't exist.
Okay. Well, we are about to go off to the break. When we come back, I want to talk more about Jews, Southeast Asian Chinese, and other economic dominant minorities. Kevin, what happened? Back up.
There is an ongoing war right here in America. Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality. There is an ongoing war right here in America. Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
Welcome back to the show. Welcome back to the show, National Bugle Radio, with Patrick Slattery and Tom Kaczynski. And just before the break, we're talking about Jewish power in the United States, or the Jewish role, and you also mentioned the Chinese in Southeast Asia. And so I'd like to just talk briefly about these economically dominant minorities. We're very familiar with Jews because they're economically dominant in our society and in a lot of European societies. In Southeast Asia, you have most of the countries have these Chinese minorities that are economically dominant. And then, of course, you can make the case of Indians, you know, Southern Asian Indians in some places in Africa and Fiji and some other areas. Or even Lebanese in certain countries in Africa. So you do have this phenomenon. But one thing that I think really distinguishes Jews as opposed to, say, the Chinese in Southeast Asia is I don't think anywhere in – and you have had violent backlashes against the Chinese, at least in some areas. I mean, I was in Malaysia once when they were having race riots between the Chinese and the Malays. And that was in the 1980s. In 1965, you famously had this, what they called the Year of Living Dangerously. That's what President Sukarno, I guess, was the first. He was the founding president. He termed it the Year of Living Dangerously. He lost power that year. But there was a lot of violence against the Chinese, and probably hundreds of thousands were killed. So you have had this type of, the Chinese have been resented, but I don't see anywhere where in Southeast Asia where the Chinese have actively tried to destroy the host population or replace them with a different population, or specifically try to turn them into a minority in their own country through massive immigration. the Chinese can be resented because of their success, which you might call exploitation, or maybe it's not. Maybe it's just that they're more active. But I don't think you see anywhere where they actually try to change the population through immigration, through repressing, births, the birth rate. So to me, the Jews seem unique there. What do you think? Am I missing something?
Well, I think the part of it that's tricky is that before what's happened in the West, I don't think you've ever seen a race that destroyed its own identity. I mean, if you were looking at East Asia, for instance, Koreans have a very strong identity. Japanese, Malays, Thai, Vietnamese, these are, races and ethnicities that are thousands of years old, and they have a very clear understanding of what it means to be their race. It's only in the white populations that we've been willing to contemplate this idea that we don't deserve to exist as a race. And while I certainly agree that there's been a lot of Jewish propaganda, or at least propagandists who were Jewish who pushed this position, the stranger and more interesting thing to me, perhaps, is why white people are willing to go along with it and instead have some sense of shame or historical guilt that you really don't see anywhere else in the world in any other race or ethnicity, I think, where you have this whole idea of guilt leading to abnegation. So I think that part of it's different. And the fact that we went for it is kind of a curious question I think we need to ask about ourselves. Because while I agree the propaganda has pushed us in that direction, it seems strange to me that any group of people could be socialized so thoroughly to have such wanton disregard for themselves. It's basically a violation of everything that's natural in kin and family order. And it really takes a lot and a lot of social micromanagement in the West to sort of maintain that. I mean, I don't know if you see it that way, but it's certainly something I've struggled with in figuring out why it is white people, so many of them, are ashamed to be white.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two issues here. One is feeling ashamed to be white. And then the other is, I guess, the willingness to accept outsiders, the willingness to have a kind of a universal morality that you would apply to outsiders just as much as you would apply to insiders. And we were speaking of Kevin MacDonald, and he has recently been researching this issue of, European people. The Europeans are a mixture of at least a few different ancient prehistoric races. One of which is, the Indo-Europeans, also called the Yamnaya, and they had this martial culture, a kind of a warrior culture, which was based not as much on kinship, but on ability. If you were going to rise in the hierarchy, if you were able, you could become a leader if you were a good leader and people wanted to follow you, rather than simply through inheritance. Okay, we will be back after the break with more Tom Kaczynski.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AirOutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. plus magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to aroutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at aroutfitting.com.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2, keep it today.
Welcome back to the show, National People Radio, with Patrick Slattery. And today I'm talking to Tom Kaczynski. We've been talking about all sorts of things. And we were talking during the break, and I know before the break, a little bit about the Middle Ages and Jews having been used as intermediaries by kings. And one thing that I think people in the era of nationalism, the first era since nationalism became a thing, the past couple of centuries, is we tend to just assume that you know, the rulers and the people are they're the same. That the king of Spain is Spanish and the people of Spain are Spanish. But it's not always been like that. And in fact, until pretty recently, it was very, very common to have the kings speak a different language as the people. I think the Russian czars typically spoke French, and they were Germans who spoke French and ruled over Russians. I mean, that type of thing. And if you go farther back, when Rome fell, it was toppled by pressure from these Germanic tribes, and the Germanic leaders, the rulers, came over and ruled over Spain and France and northern Italy. They were Germanic rulers, and the populations were Latin-speaking. And so to bring in a Jews as a middleman who could tax farm and do other activities that would be resented by the population, it wasn't as if they were sicking Jews on their own people. They were sicking, so to speak, sicking these middlemen on a population that was foreign to them. And so I think this is something, when we're looking historically at the role of Jews as middlemen, it wasn't as if the kings were employing them to oppress the king's own people, because the kings often did not see the populations as being their people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense to me. And if we look at it and try to trace it through the modern era, I mean, when you look at the center of Jewish power, you're really looking at finance, right? Like things like the Bank of England and so many of these great European banks and later the American banks really are caught up in the wars of statecraft. So you can look at someone like the English royal family, you know, the Windsors, you know, who were, was it Saxe, Coburg, Goethe, they were Germans from Hanover. And so in a lot of ways, you come back to this same problem, which is that while you can have Jewish finance serve certain prejudicial roles in keeping the population in line and under the thumb of the powers that be, they were always serving some interest. And it's a worthwhile question to ask, to what extent is the interest defined by money, or are there people further back pulling other strings on them, you know, who exist as a higher class? Because we see very clearly in the public discourse today, there is a sort of global elite that thinks internationally and thinks they're above nationhood. I mean, nationhood mm-hmm. is really nationalism as a thing is a pretty small swath of history, starting with arguably the French Revolution mm-hmm. and really starting to die out post-World War II. I mean, people have national identities, but that governance takes on a national character is something that, you know, you could argue has been less and less true over mm-hmm. the last 60 or 70 years. And when the elites come from a different class than the people they rule, having such disregard for them and using whomever they choose as intermediaries, I mean, it becomes a real problem. And I think it's something we see, you know, happen with multiple groups of people.
Right. Today, we expect our rulers to be from the people, to be of the people, to be this part of the same nation. But yet, it's pretty clear that our ruling class is not governing in our interests. And, you know, if you watch Tucker Carlson, in so many of his monologues or editorials, he's looking into the camera and saying, our rulers don't like you. They want to replace you.
And I mean, so many of the conflicts we deal with, honestly, are divide and conquer strategies where the permanent bureaucracy is able to do whatever they want because the different groups of people who are in the country, both those who are native citizens and in many cases immigrants or, you know, minority groups, are set to fight one another. And, you know, whether they end up being useful idiots or what's not the case, it's really hard to deal with big problems when you have to spend your day-to-day worrying about the fear of living in a multicultural society where you know other cultures are an active threat to you.
Yeah. Now, this is something, I don't know if you're familiar with Andrew Joyce. He's a British academic, and he's a close associate of Kevin MacDonald's. And he has studied the role of these Jewish, you know, economic middlemen in the Middle Ages very extensively. But, you know, one characteristic of the pre-national era, this former era, the prince, the monarch, the king, would have had the power to kick out the Jews when they became too unpopular. Although I'd like to ask Andrew, and perhaps you know, in many cases, I would think that maybe the decision to expel the Jews wasn't from the ruler, but maybe from the population itself. But the point I'm trying to get at is it seems that in the past, you did where the Jews might have been economically dominant and exploitative. They were still serving with the protection, not just with the protection of, but at the pleasure of the prince, the monarch. Whereas today, the Theresa May or Angela Merkel seem to be serving at the pleasure of, you know, these Jewish financial elites or, you know, political social elites. So there's in a way there's not necessarily a role reversal, but maybe a reversal of the power lines. What do you think?
Well, I think that the balance is different, but they both rely on each other. That, you know, it's funny. So I'm in the book I'm writing, I was writing about the 1910s, and I was writing about how you couldn't have the creation of the Federal Reserve unless you had an income tax amendment at the same time, because if the banks were going to be putting that much money out there, they needed someone to be responsible at the end of the day for it. So you have government getting involved. And I think there was a mutual relationship there where people in government wanted to do things and where banks wanted to have control over them. And to the extent bankers have more control these days, I think it's because they've overextended, or governments have overextended themselves on debt, with this idea that in a quote-unquote democratic age, we would have stability and perpetual growth, but really all we have is unsustainable debt. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because the thing about it is the people have always had, and I still believe retain, the power to withdraw these relationships. They just lack the political will or desire to do so. And if it does happen, you would see something that would probably be violent, admittedly. But there's nothing intrinsically preventing us from having a mass uprising against debt and usury. It's just we don't think that way.
So you mentioned democracy. And, you know, this is one difference between now and the pre-national era, the Middle Ages. In the old days, the kings were absolute, or, you know, had power that didn't depend on a periodic vote of approval by the people they governed. And of course, under electoral democracy, there are these periodic elections. They can be rigged, they can be manipulated, but they do take place. And certainly, what we find today in our society is that you have largely Jewish-run media that has a great deal of influence over the elections, massive influence. And so the question becomes, does that make democracy unworkable? Or, on the other hand, if we were able to talk about things openly and honestly, would democratic elections be a means of reasserting ourselves? Is a democracy fundamentally incompatible with, say, nationalist government, or is it a catalyst for it?
Well, I think it really depends upon the population itself and how aware and informed voters or citizens make themselves. I think to have a successful democracy, you need a well-educated and informed citizenry that have good facts. I don't think we have that these days.
Do we have either?
Yeah, no, we don't. I mean, I'm skeptical of democracy's ability to get us out of the mess. But on the other hand, I sort of think Herodotus had it right, where he saw that democracy usually voted itself out of existence because they'd put a strong man in eventually who would use power in such a way where the inefficiencies of democracy were wiped aside. And I think it's kind of telling and interesting if you look at sort of some informal surveys and just public reactions. Had Obama wanted to run for a third term, I think many people on the left would have been more than happy to give him power indefinitely. Mm-hmm. And I was watching the Trump rally in Pennsylvania the other day, and Trump was joking about being president for life. And I think the majority of people in that crowd would rather have that than the alternative of having the left resume power. So I sort of wonder that for all our platitudes about democracy, if we're just one ambitious leader away from having someone to assume power and assuming the military back them, I can imagine there'd be a great many people who would be accepting of that. And so I guess that even though we have a democracy, I think right now it just sort of persists because no one really has the calculation to try to make something else happen. But you see a cultural divide in this country that's so pronounced that I don't know how you're supposed to have government by one side not be seen as oppression of the other.
Yeah. Oh, and of course, my father, who actually said he had voted for Roosevelt, of course, he would have been in the army. He would have been in the army at the time. But he also voiced what he said was a sentiment that was out there that Roosevelt was had become president for life. And of course, he did die in office. He was there for 12 years and died in office. So wound up, in effect, being president for life. But there was a reaction afterwards, and the Constitution was amended to limit the term of the president. There's not a whole lot of faith in our elections. There's not a whole lot of faith in our democracy at this point. But yet I feel that if we could get back freedom of speech and freedom of the press and freedom of association, if we could simply be able to call out, I mean, I talk about Jewish power a lot, and it's not as if Jewish power is the only problem we have, but I do think it's a critical problem that gets in the way of solving pretty much everything else.
Well, you know, a big part of that, too, is just people's economics. You know, for the first half or so of American history, people worked their land, and they were largely self-sufficient. So you didn't have the economic pressures where you would get fired for speaking out. I mean, for as many platforms as we have to speak out, the truth is, if you consider the ramifications of speaking up your opinion, an unpopular opinion, people have never had less actual ability to exercise free speech because of all these economic consequences that have been attached. And to me, that's the really evil part of what's been done, is that whatever these financial institutions do, the fact that we can't talk about them without having media destroy our ability to live, to interact, and to be members of our community is the really disgusting thing that bothers me far more than the institutionality of, you know, who owns what banks or what businesses, but just that we've accepted this tacit censorship. And I think we did it altruistically to try to get along, to have peace, and, you know, as a generous and caring culture. But it's destroying us, and it's destroying the Constitution, where honestly it's just become a shell of itself, where we have rights that we're never allowed to exercise and that are so circumscribed that they lose their meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned the word altruism, and this is one that Kevin McDonald talks about. And he thinks that Europeans rate high in the spectrum of altruism and low in the spectrum of ethnocentrism, and that historically, especially Northern Europeans, who probably at least genetically have a stronger link to the Indo-Europeans than a lot of the Southern Europeans, that they were always willing to take people from other tribes and embrace them in their groups. And you think of the Norse mythology, and you remember you're familiar with the god Loki.
Yeah, the trickster god.
The trickster god, who, of course, was not from their tribe. He was not from Asgard. Mm.
It was a bad deal for Balder.
yeah, and he wound up killing their favorite god. He was a bad guy.
Maybe they should have listened to their own mythology a little bit better.
Well, yeah, but I mean, But
Ragnarok comes.
Yeah, he was... well, I guess he was part of a trade where... Woden gave away one of his own brothers, and they had a blood brother relationship. But you know, he was the other. He was from another group, and he was accepted in. And you know, for a while, it was working out okay. But in the end, it didn't really work out so well.
A lot of it, I think, with Northern Europeans. I mean, and I say this as someone who lives in the tip of Maine, looking out my window at 2 feet of snow. Is hard environments require a degree of social connectivity that you don't have in more plentiful environments. And as cultures develop that way, I think they favor people who act that way. And, you know, the combination between genetics and personality we can talk about. But it's sort of true that hard environments breed not only tough people, but people who are willing to work and work with one another. And if you're up here, I will tell you right now, I would not complain about anyone who wants to come shovel my driveway this afternoon, whereas I might complain to someone to get off my lawn if I was living down somewhere south where the weather is more temperate. And I think that's a big part of what gets lost, because you even see this to some extent across cultures if you look in that temperate band and in the northern societies and southern societies. So I think that's a big part of it, but I think over time, these behaviors, you know, become, I don't want to call it genetic memory, but that people who think that way are working together.
Okay, well, we will be back after the break with more of our discussion with Tom Kaczynski.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
For the past 14 years, it's been my privilege to host the National Intel Report on RBN, to offer a platform to interview exceptional guests, to provoke critical thought, and examine evidence, whether real, fake, or somewhere in between, and allow our audience to call in and participate with your input and questions, in order to help us all reach an educated decision and arrive at our own truth. Our world has changed. It's now been turned on its head. Real is now considered fake, and mainstream fake is now pushed as real, rather than any clear thinking, consensus, or rationale.
Those few remaining beacons of light, the ones still shining through the mainstream media lies, propaganda, and deception, are being viciously attacked at every level through attempts at censorship, threatening advertisers, jailing hosts, and even killing journalists brave enough to speak the truth to you. We are in a war for our very freedom and existence, and through these despicable acts, freedom haters, collectivists, and communitarians have shown they will stop at nothing to blot out these last few beacons of light. Truth is becoming increasingly more difficult to unmask, just as the term unmasking itself is spoken by those usually anonymous sources. They promote their lies, wishing to mask the truths by ignoring it, vilifying it, or conspiratorializing it into a black hole abyss.
Regrettably, RBN has reached the tipping point, and through internal audit and actuarial review, it has now been determined that the only life raft of survival to this network is to go the way of PBS, that being audience supported. Like a cornered animal, the left with veracity is pulling out all the stops with every effort to effectively blacken our beacon forever. Help us, folks. Help yourselves. Don't let our light stop shining. Our motto has always been, because you can handle the truth. It's time to review your budget, folks. If you want the truth to keep flowing through RBN, go to republicbroadcasting.org and become a regular monthly donor of 30, 40, 50, or 100 or more a month and ensure you keep the truth.
Welcome back to National Bugle Radio. It's Patrick Slatter with Tom Kaczynski. And, Tom, we were speaking about Norse mythology and Balder the Beautiful and Loki. And I just want to tell that story really briefly, and maybe you can tell us what lessons we can learn from it. So the story went that Balder the Beautiful, he was the source of everything good, and as long as he was around, the earth would be around, and, you know, everything would be nice. And I believe the story went that one day Woden was having disturbing dreams, and he went to an oracle, and the oracle told him that Balder was going to die, and of course he was alarmed. He couldn't have Balder die, and Norse gods were mortal; they could die, and so the gods, they went to everything on Earth to make them swear an oath never to hurt Balder. And they did, except they forgot about the mistletoe because it was so insignificant. And so everything had pledged not to hurt Balder. And next thing you know, they started having fun with this game of throwing rocks and spears and axes at Boulder, and all of these objects would deviate out of the way, and everybody was having fun. Well, Loki knew what was going on, and he went up to Boulder's blind twin brother and said, why aren't you in the fun? Well, because I can't see. Well, here, I'll guide you. Why don't you shoot this arrow at him? It'll be fun. Well, the arrow was tipped with a poisonous mistletoe, and the arrow speared into it pierced Boulder's heart, and Boulder died. What can we learn from this?
Well, you know, I think there's two things that you learn from it. Number one is that if you bring someone in from outside, no matter how well-intentioned they are, you never really know what you're going to get, and all the protections in the world won't prevent that. And I think the second thing is the greatest of heroes can be felled by the smallest of mistakes. Mm. And, you know, you and I off-air were joking about it, but I was saying it's funny to see a god basically taken down by the equivalent of, since, you know, we use mistletoe now as the kissing bell at Christmas and whatnot, that essentially you have a bad kiss with someone, and that can be the end. And the kiss of death doesn't always come with the same form. But I think that when you lose sight of who's in your group and you don't have people you can trust, that's when societies fall. And we were and have been a high-trust society. But I think part of being a high-trust society is we need to ask better questions. And the one thing I take away from what we talked about today, and that I hope we all do better going forward, is to ask hard questions. And no matter how difficult that is, we need to keep doing so. Otherwise, Ragnarok comes for us all.
Okay. All right. One last time. Where can people find you?
Absolutely. My preferred place to reach me is gab.ai/Tom Kaczynski, New Albion at protonmail.com. I will have a new website launching in maybe 2 months. When I do, I will be sure to come here and share it with you, Patrick. And as always, thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thank you for coming on. And I will be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT-TODAY.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.